Welcome to the PW Torch Livecast. I am Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter since 1987, and also PWTorch.com, MMATorch.com, and host of this, the PW Torch Livecast. Tonight, a second livecast, live as soon as TNA Impact ends at 10 Eastern, 9 Central. It will be a new show covering TNA Impact. It'll be the post-Impact show with hosts Mike McMahon and Andrew Socek, who both contribute to PWTorch.com. They would love to hear from you after Impact tonight, your reaction to all the happenings on TNA Impact, and they'll analyze the new year, the new season of the new of the program under new ownership, under Anthem Sports and Entertainment. So check that out tonight or on demand tomorrow. We're excited to add that to the lineup. And then tomorrow, Bruce Mitchell will be hosting the Friday primetime edition with Rich Fan, I believe. Yesterday, Travis Bryant, who normally is on Fridays, joined me on the midweek flagship for well over an hour talking about current events in pro wrestling, all kinds of news and fallout from Raw and SmackDown, and looking ahead to Royal Rumble and beyond. On Tuesday night, Bruce Mitchell, Torch senior columnist, joined me for an extended edition of the post-SmackDown show. And Monday night, Pat McNeil, Torch columnist, joined me for an extended edition of the post-Raw show. So it's been a busy week so far. And one of the big topics we've spoken about this week is the return of Mickey James to WWE. Well, a few years ago, I had a chance to interview Mickey James on this very program before many of you probably were listening to the PW Torch livecast. About 80 minutes of an in-depth interview with Mickey James talking about her first stint in WWE, her current run at that time in TNA, and her new country music album. I remember it being a very good interview, a fascinating interview with Mickey James. And so for today's program, we're going to run a best of livecast interview with Mickey James from back on May 10th, 2013. This is going to include some talk about the Piggy James angle, the Trish Stratus angle, the John Cena angle, and more. No topics were left off the table on this interview. And as usual, it included listener participation with calls and emails. So right after our first break here, we're going to go to that interview. It's one you're going to want to hear if you did not hear it. And I would say it's time to listen to it again if you did hear it back when we first ran it over three and a half years ago. So that's it. Now, I do want to remind you that our VIP sale is going on right now. And you can get for just 99 cents. That's 90%, more than 90% off our usual subscription rate of $10 per month. You can become a VIP member for just 99 cents. And that includes our countdown to the Royal Rumble and so much more. But we are running a special audio series of the last 13 Royal Rumble post-event VIP roundtables. I host these with Bruce Mitchell and most often also Pat McNeil, the night of the event, running down and analyzing and breaking down all the happenings in the Royal Rumble match and all the supporting matches on the show. And we started in 2004 doing VIP audio, and we're running every Royal Rumble roundtable that we've done now through Royal Rumble Sunday. And so not only will we have the last 13, but we'll also have this year's Royal Rumble in the mix, making it 14 Royal Rumble roundtables. Also, some other special Royal Rumble shows, including Greg Parks and Pat McNeil, running down the last 10 Rumble matches, but putting them in order from worst to best and breaking down why they ranked them worst to best. Which ones were awful, if any, which ones were average, and which ones were superior. That, a special show just recorded a week and a half ago, exclusively for VIP members, plus some Wayback Playback, real-time commentary on Royal Rumble pay-per-view events predating 2004, and more. When you go VIP, you have access to nearly three decades of archives of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly newsletter, which includes all of my written reports, the roundtable written reviews from the Torch staff with scores, and cover stories, behind-the-scenes happenings. Everything you want to know about the Royal Rumble, as we covered it at the time, is available in the back issues, and we have over 1,400 back issues dating back to the late 1980s. Magazine-style layout, editorials, backstage news, cover stories, Q&A, Torch Talks, and pay-per-view coverage with match star ratings and descriptions and analysis. So too much comes with the VIP membership to talk about it in-depth every time. Go to pwtorch.com/govip and you can sign up. It takes about 2 minutes. Our sign-up form is mobile-friendly. That's pwtorch.com/govip. You need to use a coupon to get the 90% off, and there is a coupon code form at the bottom of the sign-up page. And so when you get to that point, you should enter 99RUMBLE. That's 99RUMBLE. And that gets you $9.01 off a $10 subscription, therefore 99 cents for a full month. You can also subscribe for 3 months or 1 year, and it'll take $9.01 off those orders also. And you save a little bit of money when you go, actually save 21 bucks when you sign up for a year, and this will actually save you about 30 bucks when you sign up for a year compared to paying $10 per month. So it's a good deal. Take advantage of it now. It's a limited time offer, and you can immerse yourself in some top shelf analysis of the Royal Rumble the last dozen or so years. All right, and so much more. Like I said, comes with VIP membership, full details, and testimonials from current members at pwtorch.com/govip. After this break, we begin the Mickie James interview. There's a lot of content coming up, 80 minutes of a really good in-depth interview. When you're looking to tune in live to the PW Torch livecast, find out about the next episode, or just catch up on an episode you missed, go to our new website, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can select shows by specific day, specific host, and format, including a grid of our latest interviews and best of selections on the homepage. That is pwtorchlivecast.com, where you can stream our show live and listen to past shows on demand. That's pwtorchlivecast.com. And this week, today, May 10th, 2013, I am very pleased to be joined by TNA Knockout Mickie James. Mickie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you on. We're going to talk a lot about your wrestling career and also your country music career, including some new music that is out. In fact, I want to start with that, but let me give out some information on how people can participate in the show live right now here at pwtorchlivecast.com. The phone number to reach us is 646-721-9828. That is 646-721-9828. You can also email questions if you're shy or just don't have access to actually call us live during the show. Send questions now to pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. That is pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. We'll be going to your calls in just a few minutes, but I do want to shift gears first and talk to Mickie first about her music career and how these aspirations came about, and if you've always been interested in music and how that kind of balances out with what you're doing with wrestling now.
Well, it's a unique balance, actually, of trying to juggle the two careers, and I feel like, you know, how both of them run off of emotion and, you know, a lot of passion. Wrestling is more of the adrenaline side and the raw passion and aggression kind of emotion, and music for me, it's more vulnerability and a softer side, if you will.
Yeah.
Music has always been a huge aspiration. I played the violin for 5 years in school, and I grew up on a horse farm, and we would play music at the farm all the time, obviously. I've listened to music all my life, much more than I've actually watched television. And so it's just been a huge thing for me as far as just a connection, or it's just, you know, great songs will take you to a certain place in your life, or back in time to certain moments, whether it was your first kiss or your, you know, high school prom dance, or, you know, all kinds of things. So I don't know. And also, you know, being in the sports entertainment industry, being in wrestling, we spend a lot of time traveling the roads where, you know, we'll have shows, you know, throughout the whole weekends, and then driving 200 miles here, 200 miles there. And so it's a lot of time in the car by yourself. And I just found myself starting to write to songs that were already on the radio, or, you know, coming up with my own lyrics, but, you know, to melodies. And I don't necessarily play anything. So I'd have to work with, I have my guitarist back in Richmond that I would work with, and saying, okay, this is kind of what I'm hearing. It sounds something like this. And so we'd have to, you know, I'd write songs and have to trim them down to fit the music and to fit the melodies that I was hearing. And, you know, until it's like right there in front of you, you can't really do it. But, it's been a unique experience, you know, and obviously wrestling has always been a massive love of mine. I grew up a wrestling fan, and I watched it with my dad, you know, when I was a little kid, and just it's always been a huge part of my life, but music also has. And so it's like my two different loves that are unique, yet they're very, they've ran parallel in my life, you know, along the same way. So I've just been really fortunate in doing all this to that because of who I am in wrestling and, you know, the name of kind of made for myself through all these unique experiences and through, you know, being pretty fortunate, you know, to make it as far as I have. It's really helped me in the sense of meeting the right people and, you know, working with some incredible talents as far as in the songwriting side and in the studios and the musicians and just all along the way. It's just, I feel like I'm starting, you know, all over, like at the indies again, but on the music side, if that makes any sense.
Oh, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Your album, Somebody's Gonna Pay, just came out a few days ago. And
I know.
It's very, very new. I'm staring at the song list in iTunes, and so it is available in iTunes, and I assume people can they order the CD if they want a hard copy CD through any particular retailer or website that you recommend? How do people get their hands on this?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's all over. Like, Walmart picked it up. It's in some select Walmarts across the country. It's in FYEs across the country. Best Buy has picked it up. Obviously, you can get it at my website, NikkiJames.com, and then shop TNA, because TNA is kind of working with us to, you know, to really make this, you know, kind of magical. So they've made this whole special, like, shop TNA package where you can get the new T-shirt. Like, they have the exclusive Somebody's Gonna Pay T-shirt and, you know, the banner or 8x10. You can get all these things, whether signed or not signed or in a package, or you can kind of customize it on however you want it. So there's several places that you can get it if you prefer, you know, the physical copies rather than the downloads. And, of course, if you want to download it, it's iTunes and Amazon, and it's on Spotify now and Rhapsody, and it's pretty amazing.
That's exciting.
I'll tell you what the most amazing thing was, is to see the amount of support from my peers and my friends. Like, I wanted to cry like a baby. Like, you know, it was really overwhelming. It's like, because you kind of ask and say, like, hey, and I was a bit apprehensive to ask and say, hey, guys, would you, you know, if you get a chance and if you have time and if you want to, could you possibly maybe just mention the fact that I might have an album out or whatever? And you know, I'd be incredibly grateful if you did. And the amount of people that did, it's making me all tear up right now to think about it. Like, it's just like, it was overwhelming. And I just want to say, I mean, I know I've thanked them publicly or socially or whatever, but right now I can't thank you guys enough. And like, it truly meant the world to me. It was amazing. It really was.
I'm sure you're proud of the album on a whole and how it turned out. Is there are there two or three songs in particular that you're most proud of that either you think speak to you and that you feel the most connection to, or just musically you're the most proud of how it turned out, and maybe mention it by name so people kind of know what songs to seek out to sample the music you're most proud of?
Well, absolutely. You know, obviously we put Hardcore Country on there as a bonus track, which is really cool because it's my anthem. It's my entrance music. TNA made the music video to that, and that was kind of like the first piece of this of that puzzle, and it kind of ended up coming back, and we're like, well, we might as well just put it on there for it. But the song that I'm probably the most proud of is 80 Proof, because my guitarist back home, Buck Ruth, and myself wrote that song. And to see a song that you wrote that, you know, come to life, and all these musicians that, because we'd played it out and, you know, at bars, we played it at concerts and stuff, but it was more of like a bare bones kind of feel. But to see it come to life and all the music really get put into it, and with these top, like, five-star musicians working on it, it just came to life, and it turned into something really magical. And it's also, like, an honor to see something that you wrote stand side by side with the top songwriters in Nashville. Like, the music that I got for this album that you know, we pulled for this album, like, it came from some of the best songwriters all over Nashville, all over the country. You know, A Good Time, one of the songwriters on there, her name is Bridget Tatum. She also co-wrote She's Country for Jason Aldean, and She's Country was number one for, I don't know, months. You know, like, I think it was, you know, 20 weeks straight or something, it was number one. So to have people like that on your album, and then, you know, my guitarist that's on the album, he plays with Lady Antebellum. And so, I mean, they're just amazing. It was just amazing. Like, I couldn't have been blessed with better people. And, my producers to get the sound out of me that, you know, it was really imperative, I think, to go in the studio this time with this album and really trying to hone in and find my unique sound and sing the songs that I want to sing, that I can relate to, that I love, that, you know, I feel, and that hopefully that my fans would feel as well, you know, and that's really the key part of it.
It seems like Somebody's Gonna Pay in Best Damn Nights, the first two songs on the album, are like high energy sing along, like songs you could just imagine somebody driving down the road singing along to them once they get the lyrics in their head. Did you want to have that kind of sound and feel to your music, or did you want to have? Is that kind of where you feel most comfortable, or do you want the whole range of that country can reach in terms of the way the music?
We wanted a well rounded album, obviously, and. Somebody's Gonna Pay is actually an old Jamie Hartford song, and when I first heard that song, it was very traditional, very old country. It was, I mean, in the sense of like early 90s, I think, it was just his version of it was very country. And when RS first brought that song to me, he's like, "Oh, what do you think about this?" And I was like, "I love the song. I absolutely love it." I was like, "I just don't know if I can pull that off. Like, it's very country." And he's like, "Are you kidding me, girl? Like, we're going to slam some guitars on here and we're going to rock it up and you're going to own this song." And I was like, I trusted him on it. I was like, okay, I mean, if that's what you think, then I completely trust you. Because it was like a struggle to find those magical songs. Because when I first went in, I used that Kickstarter program to first help launch the first half of this album. And originally we were just going to release that six-song EP that I worked with my first producer, Jamie Lee Thurston. And that second song, the Best Damn Nights song, myself, Jamie Lee Thurston, and Porter Howe, who's with Little Texas, and he was with Little Texas for years, we co-wrote that song and worked together to make that one. So that one was more of a fun, like, it's fun. It's a great song. It's one of those songs of, like, that you can, especially, I don't know, being a woman or whatever, like, and it's coming from where I come from, because I find that what we do, this professional wrestling, is very intimidating, you know, for people, as far as, especially in relationships and stuff like that. It's very intimidating because you're the strong, powerful woman, or at least you're perceived as the strong, powerful woman on TV, when in reality we are just all human, aren't we? But that was kind of like the theme and the catch of it, like, oh, you know. But, and then Porter also played the guitars on the first six tracks. And when we were getting ready to release it, that's when my management, at Big Show Music, Jeff and Al, started talking to agencies and talking to labels in Nashville. And out of nowhere, E1 Music Nashville and Dan Fletcher there, he just was like, "You know what? I dig what you're doing here, and this is awesome, and it's unique, and I love it." And he's like, "But, you know, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right, so let's go back to this." So this album took longer than what I expected, than what I originally thought it was going to take to make. Because he's like, "We're going to go back in the studio," and that's when RS came into the picture, and he produced the last six songs, and it was just cool. It was cool to see the whole thing mesh together and come to life, and so many important people, like, be a part of it.
Very cool. Let's go to the phone lines, Mickey, and see what callers have to bring up subject-wise and question-wise. Certainly, if you want to talk about Mickey's music, if you've heard it, if you're a fan of it already, that's great. If you are a fan of country music and want to ask her about that, we absolutely invite those calls. Since we're a pro wrestling show, we'll probably get wrestling calls also. So the phone lines are open, 646-721-9828 is the number. Let's begin with area code 240, and on deck is 347. 240, please state your name and where you're from.
My name is Ryan. I'm from Cumberland. Mickey, I saw you at a show in Ridgely, West Virginia. It's called Beautiful Babes to Wrestling. This is back in 2001.
Oh, God.
Stephanie Goodwin. good memories of wrestling there, like any like good backstage stories like in the locker room? Because I think that you could probably come up with pretty good ones with that veteran.
Oh, gosh. Those shows were a lot of fun. Those Beautiful Babes of Wrestling, it was an all, for if you, in case you didn't know, it was an all-female show. There was a few male talents on there, but the male, like, whereas normally the shows would be, you know, a female would, there was usually one female match and then the a female as a manager or something like that. We had, like, one male manager or two male managers on the show, and but it was all women other than that. So it was like a revamp of GLOW kind of deal. They were fun because they were all girls that I trained with and that I'd worked with or worked with on the indies, and that was one of the better ones as far as those all-girls ones at that time. Like, now they have Shimmer, which is actually, like, high-quality ladies wrestling. But, yeah, they were tons of fun because most of those were all in, like, those kind of bar atmosphere kind of deal. They were very interesting. I'll say interesting, but, you know, definitely a learning experience for sure. How to wrestle in front of a bunch of drunk people. Right.
Yeah. Ryan, anything else for Mickey?
Yeah, one more question. Have you ever written any songs about your fellow wrestlers? And, like, if so, who was it and what was the story about?
You know, I've written songs about not just fellow, just most of the songs that I write or that I feel, they're not just, they're, most of them are from my own personal life experiences because I only know what I was feeling at those moments. And that's kind of where you pull in to where, at least for me, of the feeling of the song. I have written about other people's, or like from an outside perspective of how I thought they might be feeling. No, not in particular any wrestlers, though. Mostly like friends or family if they've gone, whatever they've gone through, or just kind of as an outsider looking in.
Ryan, we appreciate your call.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
All right. Our phone number here at the PW Torch Livecast is 646-721-9828. We are here 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and sometimes Sundays after pay-per-views. We are on at 5:30 Eastern, 2:30 Pacific, Tuesday through Fridays, and Mondays we're on in the hour preceding Raw. We hope you'll join us every day live. If you can't listen live, you can subscribe to our feed on any RSS, and enter our RSS feed into any podcast-type feeder or iTunes, and you can download the shows and listen. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app on Android or the Beyond Pod app on Android or the Podcaster Downcast app on iTunes. And as always, you can find all the links you need at our main website, pwtorch.com. Visit us every day at pwtorch.com for the latest news and commentary. Today's guest here on the PW Torch Livecast is Mickey James, current TNA Knockout, whose album just came out, her new country album just came out a few days ago, titled Somebody's Gonna Pay. Check it out on iTunes or many of the places that Mickey talked about earlier in the interview. If you want to call us here on the show, the number is 646-721-9828. That is 646-721-9828. Let's go to our next call, area code 347. Please state your name and where you're from.
Hello, this is Chris in New York.
Hey, Chris, what have you got for Mickey?
Hi, Chris.
First off, I want to wish you best of luck on your music. And this is actually a WWE question. When you were in the company, did you and the other females feel like you were secondary to Trish Stratus? I mean, because ever since she left the company, the women's division has been really taken like a hit, and it doesn't get much attention. So did you feel that since she was a company girl, once she left, that the company never really...
I don't really think that's fair to say. I think that I was fortunate enough to work with Trish on her way out, and I think that she did an amazing job of kind of passing the torch over. I felt like even after she left, we still had a very, very strong women's division. We had Beth Phoenix, we had myself, Natty, Melina, and I don't think that was necessarily, now as it's trickled off, like I can't give a fair estimate of the women's division today because I don't watch it enough to even judge it, and it would be very unfair for me to do that. So I won't even begin to do that, and it's not fair for those girls that are actually in there busting their humps and working because it's not a job for anybody. You know, you're on the road 200 days out of the year, and it's definitely not something that anybody can get up there and do. So I don't think that I don't think that the women's division died when Trish left by any means. I mean, because, hell, I was still there, honey, and I'm pretty awesome. No, I'm just kidding. I'm joking. Totally joking.
Do you think when Trish left, and maybe part of Chris's question is, did WWE lose any enthusiasm for promoting the division? Did you sense that at all at that time? Just because Trish was kind of the John Cena of today and the centerpiece of that division, not that there weren't other assets, but maybe that's where he's coming from?
Right. No, I can see that. But I think that the thing is that obviously that Trish was, you watched Trish grow as a performer on television, and the WWE made, you know, we knew who she was from if you were, you know, a fan of the fitness world and that kind of modeling aspect, but you watched her grow as a performer, go from someone who wasn't a wrestler and was just an arm piece and an eye candy kind of deal to learning how to wrestle and becoming one of the greatest women's champions of all time, like, not even arguably, you know, so to be able to do that in front of the people's eyes, I think there was a common bond with the people as well because they felt that they watched her grow, not only within the company, but with, you know, just in front of their eyes. And I feel like there's that same bond with the company itself. Like, they felt that same way because they watched her grow from a fitness competitor who came in as a valet and a manager into an amazing women's wrestler champion and, or, you know, a household name. And, you know, but when she left, I felt like, you know, myself, like she, I felt like there was like that bit of torch passing because, you know, you have to do that. You have to pass it on to the next generation of females. And, you know, and Lita did the same courtesy, I thought. And so, and she was still there when they left. And I get, like, I can see what you're saying. Like, there isn't, like, obviously, they're not, the women aren't doing cage matches as much anymore, but it's also a different time, and it's more PG-driven and more about, you know, sponsors and such like that. So there's many people that you have to answer to when it becomes business, more business. You know what I mean? So I don't think that, I don't even know how to answer that. I don't even, because I don't want to discredit any of the women that are in there today, but I certainly don't want to take away from the legacy that the women, when I was there or even prior, like the Molly Hollies and the Jazzes and the Jackies and, you know, Lita and Trish, and they all paved for us, in, you know, all the way down the line. And I think through every generation of women's wrestling, it's had a unique style. Like, you won't see a Luna Vachon on TV right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
But it can always, and Wade, I'm sure you can speak for this. Like, it always circles back around. Like, it goes through, and it's the constant. It's always done that. It's like a roller coaster ride. But at the end of the day, it is wrestling, and it always comes back to the wrestling.
Dawn Marie, I did a long form Torch Talk interview with her for my newsletter years ago, and after her WWE run came to an end, and she was pretty outspoken against some of the ways that the women were brought into pro wrestling, going through Diva Search competitions or being pulled from modeling agencies, and they didn't really know the pro wrestling history. They didn't respect the pro wrestling history. They didn't have to go through what you and many other women did in terms of working those indie shows and learning how to wrestle in front of drunk fans, as you put it. Did you, in your time in WWE and even now in TNA, and you can speak in generalities to make the answer a little more politically safe, but have you seen a change in how some of the women approach wrestling and the level of appreciation they have for the history of what pro wrestling is?
Well, because of that very reason, and I can get where Dawn's coming from with that, because obviously I worked my way up through the indies and scratched and clawed and was very grateful and very, you know, honored when I finally got that position because it was something that I dreamed about and strived for and worked really, really hard for. So there was a bit of, I think when that initial, like the Diva Search and all that stuff came out, there was that initial, you know, setback of going like, okay, I've dedicated X amount of years of my life to make it to this point, and here I am training these, you know, Diva Search girls who are going on TV before me, and I'm still sitting in developmental. Like, I will admit there was that little bit, but when I actually sat down with myself and looked in the mirror and I go, You know what? If I was in their shoes, I would have done the same thing. If I would have been able to get an opportunity like that and capitalize on it, and who wouldn't have done that? Who would not? You know what I mean?
So
it's like I can't fault them for doing that, and especially when, Michelle McCool, for example, who is an amazing athlete, an amazing wrestler, but she came from the Diva Search.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like Layla, for example, who's stuck around and she's stayed on top for a very long time, and she came from the Diva Search. So these girls that, you know, that perhaps that you were like, oh, you, as you're, because you're all at the same point, you're all fighting for that same position. And this is prior to me getting onto TV, you know what I mean? So this is once I got to TV or whatever and I thought about it and I sat back, I'm like, I really can't fault these girls. It's just like American Idol. You can't fault them for going on there and trying to be a star if it's something they love and want to do. Everybody has a different avenue on how they get in. It's just once you get in, how you maintain it and keep it.
I think where Don was coming from is a lot of what you said, I think she might agree with some of it. She might disagree with some of it just out of resentment because it was still fresh in her mind, you know, how these women were brought in. But I think part of it was the attitude of those women sometimes not wanting to learn about the history of the division or not know the story of those who paved the way before them and looking at it.
Oh, and I'm sure that's frustrating. And it's very frustrating for someone who has sat there and studied it and went back and watched tapes. And I love Don to death, and I know exactly where she's coming from, and I totally get it. And I think that would be the perception of many women who have fought, and it's including people that were on the indies and stuff and fighting and clawing and trying to make it, and here comes such and such girl who doesn't even know who the champion is at the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're just going, what?
Or want to learn.
Yeah.
Not only doesn't know, but doesn't even care to learn. I think that's
sometimes
a frustration.
But those girls didn't stick around, though,
did
they? They didn't last.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's the thing, is that it always comes back to the wrestling. And it is a very tight-knit group, and respect goes a long way in this industry because it is earned. And then, you know what I mean? So it's like,
absolutely.
That kind of thing is like a novelty, and it doesn't last long unless you want it and you truly love it.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan because you're listening to the PW Torch livecast. There's a good chance you're also a fan of the UFC and all of mixed martial arts. And if so, we hope you'll check out our sister website at MMATorch.com, covering the news of MMA every single day with breaking news, exclusive analysis, an array of columns, live event coverage, flashbacks, and so much more. Check it out. That's MMATorch.com or download the free MMA Torch app in the iPhone and Android app stores. That's MMATorch.com. If you're just joining us, I'm Wade Keller, hosting the PW Torch livecast Friday, May 10th. It is 6 o'clock Eastern. I'm joined by TNA Knockout Mickey James. You can watch TNA Wrestling, of course, Thursday nights on Spike TV. Mickey, we have an email question from Scott Briller along these lines. I'll read a couple sentences of it here. Mickey, first, I loved your run in WWE, starting with Trish Stratus in 2005 and ending in the spring of 2010. I don't want to give you all the credit, but the Divas division has been in a total nosedive ever since you, Trish, and Beth Phoenix left. I don't know if you follow the Divas at all now. I hope you don't, but the division is almost non-existent. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions on improving it like it was when you were there? So you can extrapolate from that what you want, but do you have some suggestions or things that you're especially proud of the way that your era in WWE handled things, and maybe things you're proud of now about TNA that you would hope would carry on in the future?
I think that, it's not fair for me to assess the division right now because although I have seen some matches here and there, I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and study it. So, but I think the beauty of what we had was that we were very much in tune and in charge of who we were on the show and what we represented. And when I say that, I don't mean like, oh, well, we wrote or we told them who we were, not in any aspect whatsoever. But there was that mutual respect between you and the writers and creative to be able to create these magical moments of who your character was, where it was going, and everybody was different. Everyone was unique, and nobody, like, there wasn't one character on there, male or female, that was remotely the same. You know, we all had our own style. We wrestled differently. We had different looks. We had different gear. You know, the way we walked, talked, every aspect of us. There wasn't one thing that was, it was all unique. And that comes from, I think, being, you know, prepared for those moments and knowing who you were and comfortable who you are in the ring and not trying to be something that you're not or not trying to be someone that you're not and just being true, you know, trying to be true to whoever you're portraying on that thing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Everything was so elaborate and so unique, whereas I don't know how you get back to that. Unless it's just a total, like, I don't know how to get back to that because it's like I said, I don't want to sit there and negate anybody who's on television now because I'm sure that they've worked very hard and they're, you know, trying to be their own individual as that goes. So I think what it's just for me, it's just like, it was cool because, you know, you had a kind of some type of input into what you were doing and who you were on that screen. And, you know, when you're given something and you had the opportunity to sit with the writers and go like, okay, well, whether it was a promo for saying, you go like, okay, can I say it more like this? This is how I think that my character or whoever I would feel like saying it. And you work together to make it to where you're getting across the same points that you need to get across, but you're making it magical because you're owning it and making it your own and not just what you know, rehearsed or whatever, because that's really what it takes down. In order to be a believable character, you have to believe it yourself. And if you don't believe it, then you can't make the world believe it.
Did you have a writer or a couple writers you in particular liked working with during your time there?
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, Stephanie was amazing. She was very much a strong aspect in that whole storyline with Trish. And also Brian Gerwitz was amazing, and David Lugana, like all of them actually were really, really cool. Like David Kapoor, there's so many people because it was different storylines depending on the storyline itself. Michael Hayes, like they're all amazing. And if you just, it's one of those things of just being able to talk to them like real people and also being able to go, you know, being able to take a no and go like, well, but why? You know, like, okay, no, but why? Because will you tell me why your way is better than my way? Because I just, you know, because that's the only way you're going to learn. It's okay to be told no. Like, no is fine. I forgot. I've been told no way more than I've been told yes in my life. But you know what I mean? It's like, but I want to know why so that way I can learn from it and see how I can grow and get better. Because every day you're getting, I still learn every time I go out there, you know, regardless of who I'm in the ring with or working with.
Another email question. This comes from Sean from California. He says, hi, Wade and Mickey. First of all, I had the chance to meet Mickey at a WWE house show a few years back, and she was very nice to me and posed for a picture. I really appreciated her for that. My question is, Alex Greenfield has said on the livecast, he's an ex-WWE writer, by the way. He was on the show before, and he says he was on the livecast before, and so the storyline he wrote that he was most proud of was the Mickey Trish biggest fan turned obsessed stalker. Was this a proud moment and a highlight for Mickey, or was she embarrassed or uncomfortable with it and didn't really want to do it when she was first pitched it?
Are you kidding me? No. It was I'll tell you what. Here's the thing with that storyline. I can say this openly. I first wrote that story. I wrote 18 weeks of TV. When I was sitting in Louisville, because we would sit there. I was supposed to debut several times. And when I say I wrote this storyline, I wrote the skeleton. You know what I mean? I wrote this idea of this crazy character, super fan, bouncy, bubbly, who seemed like a baby face, but had like a little bit of a, she was a super fan. She was just, you know, overwhelmed, loved wrestling, loved, 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 loved wrestling. And when I first wanted to pitch this idea, I didn't know Trish. I had several tryouts. I had, you know, was supposed to debut a few times and then, you know, still sat in Louisville. And I was at the point of like, okay, I really need to think of something that's going to be just awesome and unique and like nothing else that's going to, you know what I mean? Something that's just going to be really, really cool. So I just kind of thought of this character. And then I called Amy, I called Lita, and I was like, hey, I'm kind of writing this storyline and this is an idea, and I want to pitch it. Is it okay if I use you? Like, is it okay if I, you know, whatever? She's like, yeah, sure. She doesn't care. She's like, yeah, sure, man, whatever. I don't care. Whatever. And so that's how I originally had pitched it, to be like the super Lita, crazy fan. And I have to say, like, the history is because I knew Lita from when I was working the indies coming up. And, like, she was, when I'd work those Carolina shows in front of 100 people or whatever, she was sometimes, if she had nothing else going on, she'd be at the shows and she would, you know, say, like, you know, she was always super cool, but she would, you know, help me in the sense of, like, with my matches and say, like, oh, that was great. That was okay. Don't ever do that again. those kind of, you know, very valuable lessons. But, so I felt comfortable asking her, and she was the only person I really knew that was up there that I did feel comfortable, like, kind of pitching something out. And so I heard Michael Hayes when I would come back up, and it was when they had come through and they were in that Ohio Valley area. Michael Hayes comes up to me, and he goes, okay, so we read the idea that you wrote, and Vince really loved it. And I go, really? He goes, yeah. And he goes, I suggest that you go, maybe remind Vince that you wrote that idea and maybe tell him that you're the only one that can do it. And I go, are you kidding me right now? Like, what? And he goes, well, I'm just saying. And then that was it. They just kind of, you know, sauntered off in his Michael Hayes way. He popped it in reverse and moonwalked out of there. Not really. He didn't really pop it in reverse or moonwalk. No. So that's what I did. I sat around after the show until well after the show was over, outside of Vince's office, nervous out of my mind to the point where I thought I was going to pee my pants, and, like, just waited for him to finally come back. And then when he did come back with his glasses, like, down to the tip of his nose, and, like, I was like, Vince, can I have a moment of your time? And he's like, sure. So it just kind of was like, and here I, my heart is, mind you, I can hear it in my ears. It's beating so hard because he's a very intimidating man.
Yes.
And I'm like, he's a very intimidating man, but he's super cool. Like, I know he has that perception of, like, oh, he's super cool. So he goes, I heard that you had read my storyline idea and that you really liked it, and I just want you to know that I wrote that character. I know that character inside and out. Like, nobody's going to be able to play that character like I am. And he goes, huh, okay. And I go, okay. And he goes, that took a lot of guts. And I go, okay. He said, all right, then. And that was just it. That was it. And I go, so I walked out of there, and I'm like, oh, my God, what have I done? I don't know what's happening. And drove back to Louisville, and you know, it was about 6 months later that they actually called me. And the whole 6 months, I'm going, oh, my God, what have I done? What have I done? Like, this is crazy. I can't believe it. And so I sat back in Louisville for those 6 months, and then they were like, hey, we're going to, you know, you're going to debut on Raw. And I go, okay, cool. And I had no idea that it was going to be this character. And I got there, and since I had was supposed to debut it several times at this point, I didn't even bother to call my family this time to let them know until right before I was supposed to go out the curtain. I just, you know, quickly text, like, my mom and my sister and my dad and go, hey, make sure you're watching Raw or whatever, and that was it. And then, so I just kind of created this character, but it was with the magic of working with the writers, with Trish, with Stephanie, that had molded this and created that storyline of 6 months worth of, you know, like, they may have used a couple bits and pieces of that storyline, that arc that I kind of wrote, but it was, you know, obviously the magic of the writers and the character development and working with Trish and myself and everyone together that made that so special. But I was so nervous that day. I'll never forget that day for the rest of my life. It was one of the scariest but, like, most exhilarating moments of my life. I'm going, oh, my God.
How much did you get to interact with Vince McMahon, how often did Vince McMahon interact with you directly during your years in the company?
I mean, he's obviously, like, he was there at every TV and everything. He was always friendly to me and always, you know, super cool with me as far as, you know, thumbs up. If it was something that he hated, you know, if you did something wrong or he hated it, you would surely know about it. And if he loved it, you would know about that too. But it wasn't very direct interaction with Vince that I ever got. That was probably the most direct interaction I ever had with him.
Okay.
And yeah, a whole. Sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As far as, but, yeah.
With another, this is an email question from Joseph H., who has an angle that he didn't like. He says, can you tell us about how the Piggy James angle was thought up? Was this a cruel joke by Vince? As someone who has dealt with weight issues my entire life and have family and friends who have as well, I found the entire angle to be completely distasteful. Not only was it cruel, but it insults the intelligence of the fan base, since Mickey is obviously one of the most beautiful and talented women in the world, let alone WWE or pro wrestling. Thank you, and good luck on your music career and with TNA. I watch every week.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. You know, I think there's a lot of mixed emotions about that whole angle. And I don't know exactly where it came from. I know that Layla and Michelle were doing that whole Mean Girls kind of thing. And I can tell you that working with the girls, like, they would come to me and go, like, I'm not really comfortable saying this, or I'm not really comfortable doing, I don't, you know, and I was like, no, if this is what we're going to do and this is what we're going to say, let's do it, let's freaking own it, and let's steal the show with it. And I feel like because bullying at that point and social and our culture, it had come to the forefront of, it was such a major issue in schools and just society, that it was a way for the company or whatever to attack it kind of head on and to address it in both a comedy way, but also that overcoming of it. I don't know where it came from, and to me it never really mattered. You know, like, obviously, like, it's hard not to let your emotions, because I'm the type of person that's like, I have to feel every moment when I'm out there, so it's hard not to let them kind of get intertwined sometimes. So, you know, obviously, like, you're an actress and you're working and you're trying to do this thing, but sometimes it wasn't the easiest task to do. Because it's like, you know, I was not the most popular kid in school growing up, you know, I was not. I played the violin, I was a nerd, I, you know, was very into my studies and my horses, and, you know, I had a handful of friends, you know, in the small town that I grew up in. So I could very much relate to, although, you know, it was more about weight issues and stuff like that, I could very much relate to the nitpicking and getting picked on aspect of it. So it kind of did hit close to home, but I think that Michelle and Layla own those moments, and had they not been so great at being so nasty, I wouldn't have been able to really hone in and own those moments and really take, you know, go back in time and kind of own those moments, if that makes any sense. So it does, like, I can see how it did get a lot of mixed reactions, and but I think it also raised a lot of awareness of how ugly bullying and that side of society is, and in all honesty, how it is more the bullies that are insecure and the sad cases than it is the people actually getting bullied. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Because it's actually those people that are doing the bullying that need that social acceptance, that need to put down others to bring them to their level of how they feel about themselves, rather than, you know, trying to raise people up. And so it really kind of addressed it head on, and it was kind of a twisted way to do it, but I think it worked.
Did you ever, behind the scenes, have any kind of overt or subtle pressure to look a certain way, or if you put on some weight or got too curvy, was there some code word that was used to let you know that it might be in your best interest to lose weight? Molly Holly talked about that when I interviewed her right after she left WWF years ago, just about, you know, that there was a certain standard that WWE expected women to have, and if you didn't fit that, you know, those signals came to you in different ways. Did you ever feel that, and did you at all, even though you talked very well about the message that was being sent, with how nasty the heels were in the storyline, did you ever feel that this was a personal jab at you in any way?
I would hope not, because that would be a very twisted and childish jab. You know what I mean? Like, I would hope that someone, especially being at that level, that I never took it that way, because in my mind I felt like it's a very upfront business about so many things. Like, people are quick to tell you exactly what they're thinking, so why wouldn't they just say it? You know what I mean? So I would hope not, because that would be very high school if it was. But And if it was, then I was completely, then I was blind to it. Obviously, yeah. I feel like when you are on television, you know, you're, it's your own psyche as well. It's like you want to be in the best shape possible. And obviously, I recognize right now I was not in my best shape possible at that moment anyway. I was feeling a little fluffy. So, but I also, in that last year, I was home 20 days out of that entire year because I was working on my first album. I was on the road 250 days. I was working on that first album. I was literally home in my own house 20 days probably out of that entire year. So I was already so it was a mixture of things, road weary, stress, emotional, just everything. There was many things that were kind of, I was already kind of dealing with at that moment. So I wasn't probably my most confident that I'd ever been in my life at that point anyway, just because I had so much going on. And I'd really overdone myself. I kind of like, you know, I was burning the candle at both ends, the middle and in between those points too. So it was just, and if I feel like perhaps that maybe it did suffer, but it wasn't one of the, you acknowledge that stuff, like, and especially because you're standing next to, even right now, you know, right now, even at TNA, you know, you're standing next to all these gorgeous women who are in amazing shape. And you, so it's a constant competition, like, well, we have to, you know, everybody has to, if you got to, you know, you got to look slam and it's television, you know, one extra inch you feel like looks like 10, you know, so you're constantly, and we are our own worst critics because it's such a cosmetic business, you know?
And so, I think one of the criticisms of WWE and just pro wrestling in general is that they think every guy has the same type. And I hear it a lot when this type, especially during the Piggy James thing, you know, where guys are like, I'm sorry, I take Mickie James over, you know, Michelle McCool and her body shape any day of the week. And it seemed like WWE and the people in charge of those storylines, the writers, Vince McMahon, whoever, didn't seem to know that it probably was a turnoff to a portion of their audience that they were almost being told what type of woman and what kind of body type should be the one that is worshipped. And granted, fortunately, in that storyline, the heels were nasty. And in the end, the message was not that it's okay to be that way, to make fun of somebody for not being as thin as Michelle McCool, who's about as thin as you get. So, but I think that...
I don't know. I think Michelle has an amazing body. Like, she's tall,
right,
she's got that athletic, like, volleyball type of player. She looks like an athlete. You know,
yeah, but
like,
but she's a thin athlete, and I think WWE made it seem like there's only one way to look and be an athlete.
Right, right.
Yeah.
When in reality, I mean, we all do come in all shapes, sizes, colors, everything else, you know, and that's what makes us beautiful, and it's kind of to own that. Like, I don't think that I was in awful shape by any means. I still think that I'm an athlete.
Yeah.
But I do recognize that I'm 5'2", and I have curves. Like, that's how God made me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you just and that's what I think people worried about is what are the teenage girls watching this feel, and does that open up the floodgates for them to be made fun of at school because the
well, and that's why I feel like that whole thing was to be kind of raise awareness on that side of it. So maybe because it was already such a big issue,
yeah,
bullying.
Yeah.
It was already and it was just being brought to light as far as in the news and in the media and all that stuff anyway. So it was kind of like, perhaps they're the way to, in our industry, shed light upon that and go like, okay, this is not okay, and this is how ugly it comes off.
Yes.
You know, and I could be totally wrong, and maybe that's just me trying to see the, you know, through rose-colored glasses, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, I probably couldn't have been able to do that storyline had I not been able to do it with Michelle and Layla really owned that. And
oh, they did.
The three of us working together and making that special was really what made that as powerful and as emotionally involved, like, as it was for so many people, because people could actually relate to it because, I mean, this is, you know, it's a reality, you know?
Yeah.
It's a reality that everybody faces. Somebody, you know, nobody's perfect by any means. Nobody's perfect. So we've all got our little flaws and stuff that we kind of look at and go like, I wish I didn't have this dot in the middle of my forehead. I don't know why I picked my chicken pox scar.
Yeah.
I'm looking in the mirror right now. But then I'm like, I own it. It's like, that's my chicken pox scar. What are you going to do about it?
I don't want to mess up your schedule today, but we'd love to have you stick around for a couple more questions if you are able to take a couple more calls.
Sure.
Okay, cool. Appreciate it. Let's go to air code 319, because 319's been on hold for a while. Really appreciate you holding. Please state your name and where you're from.
This is Andrew from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Andrew, thanks for calling. What do you got for Mickey James?
All right. I actually got like a funny story about the whole Michelle McCool storyline, and you were okay with it all, right?
Yeah, you're talking about Mickey.
Yeah, okay, because like a few years ago I was watching SmackDown with my sister, and then you came on TV, and then like trying to remember the story, like you were – I was just joking around, like, hey, it's like, well, there's Mickey James, her and her big butt and her big boobs, and we're just, like, teasing around. And then, like, a few moments later, like, Michelle McCool's, like, doing the whole Piggy James segment, and it was like, what? And my sister felt bad afterwards.
Okay.
All right, Andrew.
I know. Then even, like, no, it was just funny because, like, all unexpected. And then just a few weeks ago, like, I just saw you back on Impact, and it was like, oh, there's just, Mickey James is back, and it's like you lost weight, and it's like, damn.
Well, I've been working really hard. Well, I've been, I won't say really hard. It's just I've just kind of changed, had some lifestyle changes and stuff that is, you know, and working hard in the gym. But it's just, you know, we fluctuate.
I know exactly what you mean.
That's part of being a woman, honey, is that you fluctuate.
Andrew, do you have a question at all for us, or?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I heard a few weeks ago that you did a, you were shooting on, like, Velvet Sky. Is that all a work and everything? And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on Brooke Hogan?
I think I didn't realize that I was shooting on Velvet. And if it came across that way, I do apologize because I love Velvet. And she's amazing. And she's probably one of the nicest people in this industry. And that's, you know, that we have. And, it, and it's a, that's a hard thing to do and be because this is a very hard business to be in anyway. So if that's how it came across, I do apologize. Let me clarify,
real quick. I'm sorry for interrupting me. Do you mean shooting on her on the microphone or in an actual match physically?
No, it was like, I think it was like in an interview I just read a few weeks ago.
No, that can't be possible.
If it was, then
that's certainly not how I intended it. And, I would never do that. I would hope I would never, because I think Velvet is very talented. She's a TNA original. She has probably one of the strongest followings in TNA itself, and she's a hell of a talent, and she's a hell of a person. So I would hope that that's not how it came off.
Yeah, but I did read it a little bit. You pretty much talked about, like, how she has her own followings, and I think people took it the wrong way because I think you said, like, when you went to TNA, you already had a following of your own. Which was
well, I did. I don't think I'm being dishonest in saying that. I think that I brought, I was, and what I meant by saying that was, is I did not build my career nor my fan base in TNA. Velvet, on the other hand, being a TNA original, has a very strong TNA loyal fan base. You know, where I do have fans, obviously TNA fans and people that love me, but I also have people who already knew me as Mickey James that followed me and are Mickey James fans, you know, and I think that I don't think that that's being disrespectful back in any aspect, whether it's to Velvet or to the company or either company, and saying that. I think that's just being honest.
Yeah, you know? And that's just like the WWE machine in general. Like, you know, Awesome Kong was on TV for like a few weeks, and then like a few years later, like you would see like on a TNA fan website, like former WWE star Karma and whatever, and it's like, you know, this is a TNA-based fan site, and you're calling her Karma instead of Awesome Kong when she was only there not even that long.
I think that's such a small, like, nitpicky thing. Like, it's almost like people are just trying to find things to, like, nitpick about. Because honestly, like, yes, Awesome Kong is Awesome Kong, and yes, she was on Karma, and she's probably one of the one people that I, you know, female wrestlers that I wanted to wrestle and that I've never had a chance to. But that's just, like, little nitpicky, like whether you're WWE loyal or TNA loyal, like that kind of battle, inner battle between the fans, that it really, that has nothing to do with what we've said or who we, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And because at the end of the day, WWE, we're still, like, I'm still Mickey James, the person that kicked, you know, just been wrestling since, you know, 1999, and this is what I've always wanted to do and be, and I think that I'm very grateful for every aspect of my career, and I'm not going to negate the one just because You know what I mean? I don't see that, because without one, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Exactly what you mean.
How about Brooke Hogan? She's been put in a tough position, Mickey, the daughter of one of the most powerful wrestlers in the company, one of our most powerful personalities in Hulk Hogan. And obviously there's going to be people going, she only has her job because she's Hulk's daughter, which is true. So then she's got to prove that she belongs. Has she adapted well and proven she belongs as much as you feel free to say?
I would say, I think that Brooke Hogan has done a fabulous job. I really do. And owning who she was in this whole angle with Bully Ray, and that's a fabulous angle. And I can see that perception. And obviously that's one of the things of, like, people just love to hate on things. I really do feel that. It's just like, really? But she's done a great job, I think, of owning who she is and being her own individual. And, you know, obviously people are going to know her from Hulk Hogan. He's the biggest name in wrestling history, and he will always be. You know, like, there's very few people that stand toe-to-toe with him on that aspect. You know, Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, that level of stardom. And so for her, that's pretty big shoes to fill, and she's even said that they're pretty big shoes to fill. And you know, I think that there was a lot of that, like, oh, yeah, you know, whatever, to begin with. But I think that she's really owned her role in TNA and owned her storylines, and she's done a fabulous job.
I think she's underrated in how she's performed. I think people kind of look to nitpick, and obviously –
Exactly, and that's one of those things. Yeah, and it's like, I think she's done a fabulous job, and maybe that's just me being nice and rose-colored glasses again, but I think she's done an awesome job. And I couldn't imagine myself being in those shoes. Like, my daddy, here he is, like, one of the biggest names in professional wrestling ever, and here I'm coming in. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't imagine being put in that position. That's a lot of pressure.
I think it's a tough spot for Garrett Bischoff, tough spot for Brooke Hogan, tough spot for Dustin Rhodes back in the day, and David Flair back in the Nitro days. I mean, that's always a tough spot to be in. But nevertheless, have you ever sensed in TNA that there's resentment that a lot of TV time is going to Brooke, and you guys are the ones who are taking the bumps and going to the house shows and that kind of thing? I mean, I don't know what Brooke's paychecks are, but from a TV time standpoint, you guys are the ones going to the house shows every weekend and working the pay-per-views and taking the bumps. That's like, it's not so much hating as it is this TV time she's getting the best use of TV time, considering the other assets that don't have a Hogan name and a Hogan legacy?
Well, I can't fairly answer that question because I don't write the show, and I don't see what actually gets ratings and what doesn't. You know, so it's like, I can't legitimately from a company standpoint go like, oh, well, this isn't working. This isn't what's drawing ratings. I can tell you what I feel from the crowd when they're out there, and Bully. The thing is that Bully is just amazing, and he, you know, generates so much. This role that he's in right now generates so much legitimate heat, you know, and that's a rarity and a hard thing to get these days because of the position that the business is in, and the fact of, like, there is that kind of, you know, filtered screen pulled up and where it is that, like, so you, to pull on people's emotions like that is a really unique thing. And so, like, I mean, who's to say?
Yeah,
I'm sure that
wasn't...
perhaps there was that whole, like, you know, like you said, people, you know, and I said, people love to nitpick, and then obviously some, you know, negativity breeds negativity, and I'm just, I really would like to see the positive side, and hopefully something beautiful comes of it. So,
very good.
I don't know.
Yeah, and it's not a fair position to put you in to say, yes, Brooke should not be on TV, and we should have more time, because one, it sounds selfish, and two, it's politically destructive. So I wasn't trying to get you to get in trouble. As much as I was saying, I don't think it's hating when people are critical of Brooke, because I don't think it's personally against Brooke as much as it's pro and positive. Hey, what about the knockouts who have been here, taking the bumps, they're working the house shows, they're on the billboards in these towns? It's more of a positive, let's give them extra TV time, more than I think it's hatred of Brooke. Because I think Brooke comes across as really a likable, nice person on television. I don't really sense there's a lot of hate towards her as much as, hey, there's only so much time. Is this the best use of time? Or is there some nepotism going on? And I think that's a fair comment from the outside looking in. That was really where I was.
Yeah, no. I do get that, and I understand that. And I get where that's coming from or whatever.
Andrew, appreciate the call. Any closing words before we go?
I'm just going to let anybody else come on. Thanks. And I just want to say thank you so much for everything you've done, and it was great talking to you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
778, you've been on hold a long time, too, so we'll take your call as we get short on time here. 778, please state your name and where you're from.
Hey, this is Stephen from Victoria, BC.
Hey, Stephen. Always good to hear from Canada. What have you got for us?
Well, first I want to say, Wade, this Interview Friday format is really cool, getting to talk to the stars. I mean, I think that's awesome. And Mickey James, I just want to say I've always been a big fan of yours, respected your work.
Thank you.
Like stuff there in TNA. And I just had two questions for you. I got on a little late here, so I don't know if this was answered or anyone asked me before. But number one was, I was a big fan of Sherry Martel, and I'm just wondering if she influenced you at all. And I know, and I remember when she went into the Hall of Fame that next day, you went and beat Trish for the title. So that was always kind of a special WrestleMania for me.
Well, I've always stated that Sensational Sherry was my favorite female. Growing up as a little girl, my favorite female wrestler. And I know I was always a fan of the bad, of the heels. I didn't know. Like, I think because their personalities were so over the top, and except for, like, there was a rare few baby faces that I really did love, the Rock and Roll Express, Ricky Steamboat, but I loved Ric Flair, and I loved Macho Man, and I loved Sensational Sherry, and I loved Shawn Michaels and Sensational Sherry together as much as I love Macho Man and Sensational Sherry together. I just loved those over-the-top killer personalities, and I had the chance to... I never had the chance to work Sherry, but I did have a chance to work a show with her, and it was just, it was awesome. It was awesome to be able to meet her and hang out with her just as a person, somebody that you idolized, you know, as a kid. And then to be there to watch her go into the Hall of Fame as somebody that you've looked up to for so long and see that moment happen, it was very, very special. So I did try to, I would say, like, obviously our characters were very different in the sense that, like, I didn't have, like, scary paint on my face or whatever, but it was that owning of your character thing that really resonated with me the most, and like that larger than life, over the top, as big as you can possibly be, even if you're only 5'2". Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, she was actually really tall. She was pretty tall, much taller than me.
Steven, any follow-up?
Yeah, just one more question I wanted to ask. This is about, like, maybe, I don't know, more backstage with the wrestling. I find with the women, since, like, you know, when Trish and all you guys were in the prime, up to now with the Knockouts, I find you guys seem to be very limited in the amount of work that they let you do. It seems like the matches are, like, when I used to watch Trish on Monday night, I felt like I was watching the same match every week. And sometimes with the Knockouts, Gail Kim is the one that I find, she's a little more different. I find, like, certain spots, like we're talking about Sherry, like she always had that trademark spot of, you know, getting caught by the baby faces Hogan and getting hit with an atomic drop or getting hit with the pest lamb. And those are trademark spots, but she changed it up. And with you guys, when you wrestle, I don't see you guys doing, like, atomic drops or different moves or any different moves. I find it seems very limited sometimes with the agents. Like, are you guys allowed to go to whoever the agent is and say, okay, I want to do this move today or this move today, instead of doing, I do find it seems very repetitive sometimes with the matches, and I'm just wondering if you guys have any say in that.
Do you mean, like,
Yeah, Mickey, let me
tell you something that, I'll tell you this.
Yeah.
Just so I can, if you look at every top star right now, whether it be on TNA, WWE, Ring of Honor, I don't really, you know, if you actually look at what they do in the ring, for the most part, the top, the extreme, the elitist of stars probably have 5 moves that they do in every match that they can do on anyone out of anywhere, right? And the person who actually kind of made me realize that was Shawn Michaels. When we were on tour, and I actually talked to him, because I was talking to him about, like, what can I do to be better or whatever, and I just want to be the best, and how do I do that? Because I'm here, I am having the opportunity to talk to in my opinion, one of the best of all time. So, and he's like, you know, he said, Mickey, it's not what you do, because I do the same 5 moves in every match to everybody. He goes, It's all in how you sell and what you and how you tell your story. He's like, you don't have to go out there and hit all these crazy moves because 9 times out of 10 it may be impressive, but people won't remember it because you haven't told the right story. You know what I mean? So to say that we are limited is unfair. I think that every female has, or and male, has their own shtick, their own set of moves, and we're not trying to go out there and, A, do everybody else's moves, but also, you know, you want to keep it unique and try to keep it different. I try to switch it up depending on who I'm in there with and who you're working with, of the, what you can and can't do and what they do and how to make it work with the story that you're telling. There's a lot of things that go into it rather than just like, hey, let's go out there and have a wrestling match. You know what I mean? And that's something that I can't really make you understand because obviously it's something that you have to be in it to know it. You know what I mean? So it's hard to explain. I don't feel like we're limited by any means. In fact, I feel like we get a lot of TV time to tell our stories on TNA, you know, and we had a fair amount of time when I was in WWE to do the same things. And I think that it's just a matter of who your character is and what she does. And I don't know how to answer that properly, darling.
Well, would you like to have longer?
I feel like it's almost like a backhanded compliment where you're going, right? Okay.
Well, would you like to do longer matches? Would you like to have more time to tell stories? And do you think women are not given it? It's about ring entrances, a few hot moves, a finish, and you're done, as opposed to having maybe more opportunities to go 8, 12, 15 minutes on television?
But nobody has ever given me what moves to do. I have, you know, come up with my own moves and obviously the names and stuff like that, or you know, stolen them from a Japanese match or somewhere else. And there is no move that's never been done before, so everybody's move has been done before somewhere along the line, so I can't say that I invented any move, but no one's ever said, oh, you know, don't do that or whatever. Obviously, you know, I'm going to have a different style match with a Gale or a Tara than I am, you know, with someone who's just coming up, whether it's a girl for a tryout or something like that, just because of the level of trust and you know where everybody's at. So, you know, and it depends on the story that you're telling. It honestly does. Like, you don't need 15 minutes to tell a story. Sometimes you can't. You can try to tell that story in 15 minutes, it's too long, but then sometimes it would be beautiful to have that 15 minutes to tell the story. And I feel that we've been given, I mean, Tara and I main evented the show, you know, and it's very rare that a female will do that. We've main evented the show, and we've wrestled in a cage, and that was the first time I'd ever wrestled in a cage, you know. So to say that we haven't been given proper opportunity or amount of time or a certain spotlight is, it would be wrong for me to say, because I feel like we really do.
Yep. And I just think sometimes people see the talent in the women's division and want to see them do longer matches and tell longer stories, and they're given, again, that's not so much haters as it is people going, hey, you guys are talented. We want to see more than the ring intro in a few moves.
Yeah.
And I think you're the one, you're somebody who, when they do see you in longer matches, it shows the potential of the women's division compared to sometimes when I think many of the talented women are shortchanged and not given a chance to have those longer matches. Obviously, it's different at house shows.
Right, absolutely. You're given way more time on house shows. And the thing is that it is a live television show, and you have so many stories that you have to tell within that. I am not a writer of the show.
Yeah.
I do not try to do their job. I do not expect them to come in the ring and try to do my job. And there is a certain aspect, like, of course, I mean, everybody, but you also have to be fair in the sense of go, like, well, there's also all these other stories that have to be told. You know what I mean? So I hope, you know, you hope for the proper amount of time to be able to do that. But you also hope that everybody has the proper amount of time to tell their stories as well. You know, that's a constant balance, I think, for the writers and for the creative side. And you know, you should be able to go out there and tell the story that you need to tell, whether it's in 2 minutes or 20. You should be able to do it as a professional.
Yeah, yep.
So, you know, you always, obviously, as a, you know, you want as much time as you could possibly get, but you will be happy with whatever you get.
I don't want to hold you over. Do you have time for one or two final email questions before we wrap up with you, or do you got to go now? And either way is fine. Don't feel
No pressure.
Sorry. I mean that. I mean, because you stayed over the time that we were told we had with you, so I want you to know there's no hard feelings if you got to go, but if you have time for two more emails or something, we'll do those.
Well, two more.
Okay, sounds perfect. Jared from Kennewick, Washington, VIP member for The Torch, says, "Hey, Mickey, first off, I just want to say I consider you, Trish, and Lita the holy trinity of modern women's wrestling." See how good it is to take more questions?
Oh, that's very kind of him. Thank you. That's honored to be on that same level. Thank you.
He says, "My comment or question is this. Me and my friends have said it many times. You perform the best DDT in the business these days, man or woman. It just looks devastating. I'm always interested when wrestlers are able to perfect certain moves that are standard fare and make them into such a signature move. Can you give some insight into how you came up with a jumping spike DDT the way that you do it?"
I started doing, you know, I used to, when I first started training, I used to do the tornado DDT out of the corner, you know, like that kind of, or like the running up the turnbuckle kind of deal. And it was one of those things is my DDT is obviously, it's a balancing act because it's just as much the person underneath me as it is, you know, in fact, it's probably more of them than it is me.
Yeah.
But it really is a balancing act. And I think it was one of those things of like, this is when I started to recognize of what, when I was probably, you know, wrestling at like maybe 6-7 years at this point, and I was like, okay, what are all these people who are on top, what are they doing that is what's working and when the people react or whatever? And I realized it was like that moment where, like I said before, you can hit something on somebody anytime out of anywhere. And obviously, you know, Jake the Snake Roberts made the DDT famous. Tommy Dreamer was amazing at it, and I love Tommy to death. And I was like, well, I'd already started doing the tornado DDT, and I was like, well, I just don't want to do the standard DDT because everybody does it, and everybody does it, and people kick out of it all day long, and that was a finish for so long, and I just don't want to, you know. So it's like, well, I love the DDT, and it was just a cool move to me. So it was just one of those things of like turning that tornado DDT out of the corner into something that I could stop dead in the center of the ring and do, you know. And it just kind of worked, I guess.
It really stands out.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see the process you went through to kind of try to make it your own and have it be something that I think really stands out as a strong finisher, even though it's, in essence, a conventional move that you've made unconventional. I don't know how much you've seen of Evan Bourne. He was a guy who just amazed me because AJ Styles has done this too, where you do an ordinary move, a lot of wrestlers do, but nobody else can do it as well as they do it.
Right, and you just, it's like that one little twist, that one little modification, and Evan is incredible, and AJ is absolutely phenomenal. Like, hence the phenomenal one, but he is absolutely phenomenal. And to be, that's what makes them so wonderful, is that they can take that ordinary thing that you happen to see or whatever and make it there and just do that one little tweak to it that makes it unique and makes it special that nobody can do, and nobody can do it better.
Very cool. The last question we'll do is Matt Fanatic from Wisconsin. I'll summarize the interview, or the question is kind of long, but he wanted to know about have you dive into the 2008 storyline between you and John Cena, where you guys were apparently dating, and then is it true that you were moved to SmackDown because of some issues behind the scenes resulting from the John Cena situation? And Kenny Dykstra had said something to that effect in an interview he did, and he was citing that.
Oh, no. I don't really know where that whole dating thing. I think it was because it really didn't last very long on TV, did it? No, it was just one of those things that was like a couple of weeks, and it was like, oh, this, that, and that was just the end of it. It just ended out of nowhere. So it really didn't, the whole lot didn't really come of that. And I think that the move to SmackDown, I had been at Raw since I debuted. So I've been at Raw since 2005, and I think that move was something to like try to switch up the rosters. And it was a way to get me to SmackDown to work with Michelle. So if there was, then so be it. If there wasn't, like, but it was probably a blessing in disguise either way, because I wouldn't have been able to work with Michelle and have those magical moments and that, and with Layla as well, and those things. So I don't know.
So there wasn't a political fallout that you were aware of regarding anything having to do with John Cena on or off air?
No, absolutely not. And John has been nothing but super cool to me. And so if there was ever any political thing like that, I wasn't aware of it. But then I tend to be ignorant to a lot of things. So who knows? I wear my rose-colored glasses all day long. No, it's not. It was super. It's like, and that's the thing. It's like I did need something fresh and something new, and I needed that because I had been at Raw for so long. I'd been at Raw for 5 years, and I had wrestled every girl on that roster, and it was like during that whole draft and switch and stuff like that. And I think it was a way that they needed to freshen up both shows and kind of switch them up and shake them up a little bit. And since I was the one girl that had never moved from one to the other, that just worked.
Would you give advice to women wrestlers when it comes to, and it doesn't have to be anything personal you've experienced, but just observing the business from so many places and for so many years that you have, advice regarding dating in the locker room, with women dating men in the locker room? Is there any kind of set of rules behind the scenes on that, or advice that you would give to other women as far as how to tread that kind of delicate territory?
Yeah, you know, they say, like, that's just the whole thing is that, you know, you probably shouldn't date and stuff within the business and stuff. But you find it very hard when you're on the road.
All but 20 days.
Yeah, and you're home 20 days. Like, who do you meet while you're at home? You have time to, like, pat your dog's head and go for a ride on your horses, and then you're back on the road again. So, you know what I mean? It's really difficult because those are the people that you're with and that you're around all the time. So,
and you share a lot in common.
Honestly, I say you only live once, and it is your life. And at the end of the day, if you can look in the mirror and own every aspect of your life and accept it and with a smile on your face and love in your heart, then that is you, and nobody can take that away from you. And at the end of the day, you don't have to answer to anyone but yourself. And if you're okay with that, then that is all that matters.
Did WWE have any policies or anything written or unwritten as far as that went? Dating?
Well, it was one of those things that's like probably not the best thing, because it could, if something went sour, then obviously it could go really sour for you or your career. But at the same time, there was many people that were obviously dating, you know, so it's like, was there a written or unwritten rule? No. I mean,
yeah.
No. Yeah.
Well, it would be somewhat hypocritical for WWE to have that rule, considering two of the three most powerful people in the company, arguably, Triple H and Stephanie, met as, you know, under those circumstances. So, it's kind of
funny. That's what I'm saying. The heart
wants
what it wants. You can't deny that. And, like, so, you know, people are always going to judge, or they're going to think and have their own opinions. But at the end of the day, it's your life. You know, and if you're okay with whatever, that then that's all that matters.
Yeah. Mickey, you've been generous with your time and just very gave awesome answers and great insight. And I appreciate very much you taking live phone calls, email questions, and my questions, and my trying to field my way through some country music questions as best I could. So appreciate that. Hope I
well,
do.
Well, hopefully I made you into at least a Mickey James country music fan.
Absolutely. No, you know, I like country music, but I don't know enough about it to necessarily ask a lot of good industry questions. You know, I know wrestling a lot better. So, but hey, it was fun to, you know, try it a little bit and learn a little bit about the music industry and how it's similar and different for you.
Well, I'm still learning every day. So
yeah,
that's it. Consolation.
Your album is Somebody's Gonna Pay. That's your second album. You can get both albums on iTunes. So look up Mickey James on iTunes, or if you joined us in progress here live, you can go back and listen to many of the or listen to what you said earlier about all the places you can find the album, check that out. And we definitely recommend that. And also Thursdays, people can watch you live on Impact. Every other week you're live, every other week taped, but on Spike TV now at 8 p.m.
Spike TV, baby.
And soon to be 9 p.m., moving back on time, moving an hour later in time slot. And also Slammiversary coming up June 2nd. I assume you'll have a big match on that pay-per-view.
I hope so. Boston, I love Boston.
It's fun having only four pay-per-views per year. I think it gives everybody a chance it gives that lineup a chance to kind of ferment and build that anticipation, so it's not such a machine you're just feeding every month. And I think it's probably in this era,
and it gives you ample time, though, I think, to really invest in these storylines and build to that moment. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
rather than trying to, you know, like 12 pay-per-views a year is a lot to fill,
yeah.
you know, and try to make everyone special and build, like, storylines to each one. It's, that's, like I said, I'm obviously not one of the writers, nor do I try to be, so.
Yeah.
I'll leave that to the experts. But, you know, I only know what I know and what I feel,
yeah.
so.
Well, very good. We've been on for over an hour,
Oh my goodness! Minutes. What have you done?
I know. I apologize if I screwed up your schedule, but I feel like even just with this much time, we just scratched the surface. So I'd love to have you on again sometime on the show if you're willing, and I will put a tweet out there with a direct link to the show for you if you want to retweet it to your fans. It is available on Delay, and I will include your Twitter handle in that. And so feel free to reach out to me if you want to come back on the show a couple months down the line to talk again.
Oh, I would love to. Thanks,
awesome.
Wade. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mickey. It's been a pleasure.
You're awesome.
You've been a great guest. I really appreciate it. Good luck.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
All right. That is Mickey James with TNA Wrestling, and also Somebody's Gonna Pay, a new album just out a few days ago. It just dropped, as they say. At least I hope they say that. And you can download that, as I said, on iTunes or many other places, including retail stores with this thing called a CD that comes in a plastic case for you young folks. thanks very much, Mickey. So that wraps up the full Mickey James interview, and this gives you an idea of what you get when you go VIP. You gain access to all of our past interviews here on PW Torch Livecast with the advertisements and plugs taken out. The last several years we've been doing that. And you can just go on pwtorchvip.com once you're a VIP member. And at the top of that website, there's a category called VIP Audio. And a menu drops down, and you can choose from our Royal Rumble collection of audio shows, our WrestleMania collection of audio shows, Wade Keller Hotlines, PW Torch Livecasts, Livecast Interviews is a separate category. That's where you can scroll through all the interviews that we've done over the years. Bruce Mitchell Audio Show, The Fix with Todd Martin, Post Pay-Per-View Event Roundtables, and the Sean Radican Wrestling Audio Community, covering some of the indie shows and DVD releases in New Japan, the East Coast Cast, Pro Wrestling Spotlight, and Total Chaos Retro Radio Shows, the Wayback Playback, and more. So when you go VIP, it's just a click or two away, and you can be scrolling through and catching up on interviews that you have missed over the years, such as this one with Mickey James. That'll do it for me for today. Follow me on Twitter at TheWadeKeller, at MMATorch, at PWTorch. And remember, VIP sale. Take advantage of it now while you can. You won't regret it. PWTorch.com/GoVIP. PWTorch.com/GoVIP. When you sign up, enter coupon code 99RUMBLE. 99RUMBLE gets you 99 cents for a full month, or you can apply that $9.01 discount to a three-month or one-year subscription. We'd love to have you join our community of great wrestling fans who love what we do and our customers who endorse what we do on the show on a regular basis. You can be one of them. You can become one of them, a happy customer who calls the show, says you're a VIP member, and you love it. We'd love for you to be one of those also if you haven't yet. That'll do it for me for today. Until later tonight, I was going to say tomorrow, but until later tonight, when Mike McMahon and Andrew Stochek take over as soon as Impact goes off the air, this is Wade Keller signing off. As a PW Torch Livecast listener, you've probably heard me talk about PW Torch VIP membership. One of the great perks about becoming a PW Torch VIP member at pwtorch.com/govip is access to vintage radio shows that are only available with a PW Torch VIP membership. The entire run of the Pro Wrestling Focus radio show that I hosted on KFAN in the early 1990s, over 100 episodes, available when you sign up instantly. Also, on an ongoing basis, we're adding more Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio shows hosted by John Arezzi in New York, which ran from the late 80s through the mid-1990s. These shows have not been heard since they aired originally on New York radio, and VIP members have access to listen to them exclusively as part of their VIP membership. Also, Total Chaos Radio, hosted by PW Torch Livecast Saturday morning wrestling host Jim Valley during the Attitude Era, are also part of a VIP membership, new ones added on a regular basis. These vintage classic radio shows with big name interviews, guest analysts, including me, on a regular basis talking about the news of the day with the hosts, are accessible when you become a VIP member through our ad-free VIP website. You can stream them right on your phone or right on your computer, but also an RSS feed that is accessible only for VIP members via popular apps on iPhone, Android, and even iTunes.
Check it out. It's a big perk that comes with a VIP membership. Get details at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Have a blast listening to familiar voices from this live cast talk about wrestling from the 1990s through the Attitude Era exclusively as a PW Torch VIP member.